I'm Stephen M. Hall, MD, an integral physician.
And I'm Grace Porter, a licensed psychotherapist. And together, we're the 7 Tools, a company focused on your personal growth and transformation.
And you are here with us for the Change for Good Summit. This year, we're focusing on building resilience in anxious times.
This summit is full of deep conversation and practical advice. We hope you enjoy this interview.
So now let's dive in. Well, hi, everybody. This is Dr. Hall with the 2019 Change for Good Summit, Building Resilience in Anxious Times. I'm really excited for you to hear what our next speaker, Dr. Thomas Cowan, has to say about treating anxiety and building resilience. So Dr. Tom Cowan discovered the work of the two men who would have the most influence on his career while teaching gardening as a Peace Corps volunteer in Swaziland, South Africa. So he read Nutrition and Physical Degeneration by Weston A. Price, as well as Rudolf Steiner's work on biodynamic agriculture. So these events inspired him to pursue a medical degree. And Tom graduated from Michigan State University College of Human Medicine in 1984. And after his residency and family practice at Johnson City Hospital in Johnson City, New York, he set up an anthroposophical medical practice in Peterborough, New Hampshire. And then Dr. Cowan relocated to San Francisco in 2003. So he has served as vice president of the Physicians Association for Anthroposophical Medicine and is a founding board member of the Weston A. Price Foundation. And during his career, he's studied and written about many subjects in medicine. And these include nutrition, homeopathy, anthroposophical medicine, and herbal medicine. So he's the principal author of the book, The Fourfold Path to Healing, which was published in 2004 by New Trends Publishing, and is the co-author of The Nourishing Traditions book of Baby and Child Care, published in 2013. So he writes that Ask the Doctor column in the Wise Tradition in Food, Farming, and Healing Arts, the Foundation's quarterly magazine, and has lectured throughout the United States and Canada. So he has 3 grown children and 3 grandchildren, and practices medicine in San Francisco, where he resides with his wife, Linda Smith. So Dr. Cowan, you and I are both family practitioners, and we both started practice in the mid-80s, and we both saw how limited conventional medicine is when it comes to treating chronic disease and promoting health. And we've each searched out our own ways to solve that problem. And I have to say, too, we each have 3 grandchildren.
I actually have 5 grandchildren now and 1 on the way. So.
Well, you're ahead of me. Huh?
Yeah.
Only got 3 and 1 in the oven, so.
Yeah, I have 1 in the oven too.
So. Whoa. So I'd love to hear more about you and about your journey from the conventional training that you had to where you are today.
So I grew up in a situation where it was kind of expected of me that I would be a doctor. I mean, you know, I was good in school. My father and grandfather were both dentists. They had a lot of family friends were doctors. I was exposed to doctors, and it just seemed like the obvious thing to do. The only problem was I wanted no part of it, partly because I had a sense that doctors were not the know-it-alls and the gods that they thought. And I have a very specific example that I remember. When I was 16, I was spending time with a friend of my father in his office, and it was in Detroit, and he was a pretty well-known oncologist and internist, and he was seeing this this African-American woman who had a cough, and he said, "Oh, you have a cough and you have to take antibiotics." And she said something like, "Well, Dr. Klein, why do I have a cough?" And he said, "That's the bad air." And she looked at him and said, "Why don't you have a cough?" And I started laughing, of course, because I thought it was funny. That was, of course, the last time he invited me to watch his practice, because he didn't appreciate that. But anyways, I had a sense that there's a lot of hooey in medicine. I went to college, didn't know what to do, joined the Peace Corps, thought I could learn gardening. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I met Steiner's work and Weston Price. And at that point, it hit me that the kind of medicine that I had instinctively rebelled against and didn't want any part of was actually not the only type of medicine there is. I don't know why, but it just never occurred to me before that. And so at that point, it was like a dam broke. And I started, you know, we're now talking 45 years of almost daily looking into something to do with health, medicine, food, soil, you know, whatever. So it really did unleash something that was probably a big part of my destiny. But I decided to go to medical school, unlike a lot of people, basically not believing what I was going to be taught. I had to learn it, and some of it was, of course, interesting, and some was useful. And, you know, then I worked as an ER doctor, mostly to make money. But from day one, I was suspicious of what I was being taught, down to the very fundamental levels. Like, there was two books that I've written, and I have a third coming out. One was on the heart, and that has to do with saying that there's no way that the heart pumps the blood around the body. And the other is on vaccines and autoimmunity and how vaccines lead to autoimmune disease. So I've been questioning the fundamentals of medicine from the very outset. So I never had this huge crisis of, well, what kind of medicine am I going to do? Because I always knew it wasn't going to be conventional medicine. I knew I had to learn some of it to, you know, and when I was an ER doctor, obviously I became at least somewhat competent in doing that. And so I know the rap, but that's not what I was interested. So basically it's been a 40-year quest to figure out, you know, what is the best way to help people? What's the matter with them? And how do we go about dealing with it? And that, of course, has evolved and changed like anybody as you learn more and more information comes out and things also change in the environment.
Exactly. So it's interesting because I've met other physicians that sort of, I call it, had their awakening while they're still in training. And that made their training really, really difficult, really traumatic for them. Was that like that for you, or were you able to support yourself through that training, even though you already
I have been, and in some ways, probably to this day, I'm very good at the strategy of, I'll tell you what you want to know, and that's it. So, you know, I was also good at like taking tests and answering questions, you know, like a lot of us. So the way I would describe it is, if they asked me what causes strep throat, I could give them a passable rendition of strep and how to treat it with penicillin, right? I mean, anybody can know that. But I wouldn't say anything else, and I wouldn't ask them any more questions. And I remember when I was leaving the residency, the guy said, you know, you are the most difficult student we've ever had to treat. Because it wasn't like they couldn't flunk me, right? Because I know all the answers. I'm not saying I was the world's best student, but I was good enough. You know, I passed the boards on the first try, you know, all that stuff. But I just wasn't interested in the way that they were used to. And it's true. And it didn't bother me. I mean, I had a life otherwise. And so I just did what I had to do. It wasn't particularly hard. It was a little annoying maybe, but that's about it.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad you made it through that. So you have what you call this fourfold path to healing. So can you explain that to us and like its basic foundational concepts and where they come from? And go ahead and feel free to go into depth here if you wish.
Yeah. Also, you know, that book was actually published maybe in the early 2000s. I think the date there is wrong, but most of it was written in the mid 90s. So, you know, we're talking quite a while ago. But
yeah.
I mean, it was me who wrote it, even though I've hopefully evolved improved somewhat since then. The basic idea, though, if there has to be one, was that what we call diseases are not what we think they are. In some sense, I tell people that the main job of a doctor is to distinguish the therapy from the disease and not confuse the two, which I, by the way, think doctors are very bad at that. So let me give you an example. If you get a splinter in your finger and you don't take it out, you get pus. And if you ask the question, is the pus the disease? Because obviously we learned in medical school, pus equals infection equals bacteria, and here's the life cycle of bacteria, and then you kill it with this antibiotic because it interferes with the life cycle here, and that's the end of it. The problem is the pus is the therapy for the splinter. The splinter is the disease, and the pus is the medicine. Now, that's an obvious and simple example, which I think most people could recognize that. But if you take this example, so people put debris in their lungs, it's called smoking. And then twice a year, they get bronchitis, which means mucus and pus to get rid of the debris that they put in the lungs. And then they go to this doctor, family doctor, pediatrician, internist, and because they're confused about what the disease is and what the therapy is, they give you a medicine to stop the therapy, which is the bronchitis. So bronchitis is not really a disease. It's a therapeutic response to something you did, or not you in particular, but the person did. Mm-hmm. And I always ask people the question, what would you do if you were that body and you put stuff in your lungs? I think that the proper answer would be you try to flush it out. Now, I appreciate that it's unpleasant, inconvenient, you don't feel well and all that, but I mean, that's the only response we have. The problem is if you're confused, like most doctors are, and think that's the disease, then you do whatever it is that you have to do, antibiotics, you know, cough suppressants, whatever, and then it goes away, and then you do it over again. And then you do it twice a year, three times a year for 20 years, and then you get lung cancer. And it's a little bit simplistic, I would admit, but you could say, well, why did you get lung cancer? Well, because you have a bunch of toxic debris in your lungs. Well, how did it get there? Well, you put it there. And he or she stopped you from getting it out. And that's how you get chronic disease. So essentially, I'm just looking at what like really happens, not what we think happens. You know, most of the things we experience are our body's, you know, therapeutic attempts to, you know, address the toxic influences that we are all exposed to. And if you think of it like that, it changes everything. Now, in that book, I said, you know, there's basically three, you know, areas of life to look at. There's food, there's movement, there's medicines, and there's how we think about life. So that was the fourfold path. But I would say the evolution of that idea is it's a way of understanding medicine and in sense biology that's a whole lot different than what we are normally led to believe. Mm-hmm. Basically, we were sold a bill of goods. The biggest bill of goods of all is that living systems like us or a butterfly or a worm consists solely of physical stuff and there's nothing else. There's nothing called life, and there's just stuff. And that is a terrible lie that has led to more trouble than just about anything. And so I'm trying to bring back I'm not the only one, but actually a realistic, accurate picture of, you know, what a living being is and how it operates.
Mm-hmm. And that's really good. So you said, and some of you are right, I think in that book about, you might have answered this, but disease is best understood as the body's attempt at self-correction. And And like homeopathy's idea is, well, we'll just help that attempt. Instead of stopping it, we'll help it. Is that similar to the philosophy you're operating from?
Well, you could get into, you can get into as much depth of this as you want. Because the main principle of homeopathy is physical substances, physical living entities are more involved than just physical stuff. In other words, there's an energy body. Mm-hmm. Now, even though you could get into what do we mean by an energy body, the first thing I would say about that is that, you know, if you look at quantum physics, they say that, you know, basically everything can exist as a wave or a particle. In other words, as energy or substance. And even when you look at substance, you know, and you get right down to it, what is a thing? It's basically made of atoms, and atoms are 99.99% or more space. So they're nothing. And how does that get into having a physical stuff? Well, we don't know. Anyways, homeopathy says that there's an energy part of us, and the energy part of us expresses itself in certain symptoms, like a cough, or you feel better outside, or you feel better inside, or you're, you know, worried about something, or whatever it is. Those are your symptoms. And then you match that with the symptoms of what happens to a person if they're ingest some outside plant or mineral or even animal. If you get the same symptoms, then there's a sort of energetic resonance between the two. And if you give that one to the person who's sick, that resonance will direct their body to heal that imbalance. That's the basis of homeopathy. Now, I would also say that I don't particularly agree with all that, but I mean, that's what homeopathy is.
Right. Yeah.
The way I would put it, let me say, not the way I would put it, but the way that Rudolf Steiner put it. I mean, people have to understand that if you're talking about anthroposophy, the basic theory, philosophy of Rudolf Steiner, I mean, he questioned everything. He, for instance, said the heart doesn't pump the blood. That's one. He questioned even the whole theory of evolution. In sense, what he said was that, you know, we say in the beginning was the slime mold, and then we somehow evolved from slime mold, even though nobody can quite figure out how that happened. Steiner said the reality is in the beginning it was the human being. Now, it didn't exactly look like a human being of today. It was an amorphous, just all-encompassing something. And then over time, the different parts of the human being were essentially cast out into nature. And so when this part of the human being was formed, that became the digitalis plant out in nature. And so over time, and we're talking about a lot of time, eventually the human being as we know it formed, along with all these kingdoms and these species and beings of nature. And each happened at a certain time. And so if you have a heart imbalance, then that may have been the time where this plant called Strophanthus was created. And essentially, when you reunite Strophanthus and a human being suffering from a heart ailment, you're reuniting them with the part of nature that can heal them. So healing then is a sort of creation of wholeness or reunification where it didn't exist beforehand. So that's another kind of definition of you know, a different approach to medicine. The only thing I would say, especially for people who heard that and think this guy's sort of crazy, although that wasn't me, that was Rudolf Steiner, is when probably the most famous sculpture of all time is Michelangelo's David, right?
Yeah.
And they asked him, how did you do this? He said, well, I took this block of granite and David lived inside it, and I took all the extraneous bits away, and there was David. So that's what Rudolf Steiner said.
Oh, interesting. Wow. So, yeah, so with that background, when someone comes to see you, so how is their experience different from going to see the regular family practitioner? That's a big question, I know.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been to a regular family practitioner myself in 45 years, so I don't exactly know. But
I can tell they'll see what's wrong with you and send you to a specialist.
Yeah, right.
They won't treat
I rarely send somebody to a specialist. So over the years, I've created my own method of doing this. I don't talk about this much, and I've sort of helped other practitioners, but I have a sort of questioning technique that I learned from studying nonviolent communication and the work of Carl Rogers, who is the founder of humanistic psychology. And he said that if you want to understand what's happening with a human being, you have to hear what they have to say, obviously. And so that's what I do. So I start and say, you know, something like, what's up, or what brought you here? And then they say something. And then I start asking all questions like who and what and when, and I never ask them why. And so let me exaggerate it so you can understand. So like, let's say it's a child comes in. So all I know about the child is that he's, you know, hitting other people and the parents in the school are worried about him. So that's all I know. So I say, you know, how you doing? Fine. So what's up? Nothing. So I hear that some people are worried that you hit people. Yeah, I hit my sister. Which sister? Well, the middle one. So do you hit the older one too? No. When did you hit the middle sister? So I keep going like that, just clarifying what's happening. And what emerges is the story of the story of why this guy does what he does. Now, that could apply to the story of how you got into pneumonia or how you got MS. So when were you last fine? I was fine 2017. Then what happened? Then I got a flu shot. What was the reason for the flu shot? Well, they said I had to get a flu shot in order to work. So what happened then? Well, then I felt pain in my arm. So what happened then? And you go on from that. Essentially what happens is I want the person themselves to, at the end of it, say, hey, I think that flu shot or that exposure to glyphosate or moving next to Wi-Fi or eating only sugar or whatever, that's what's causing my trouble. I want them to come to that because it becomes obvious from them hearing themselves talk, not because I say, you know, I think this, I mean, sometimes I have to point that out. Like, do you remember that you said you were fine until you got this flu shot? Yeah, that's exactly what happened. But here's what's interesting about this. You know, I hear every single week, Tom, I thought that might have been the case, and I asked my doctor whether eating a whole lot of Roundup might, you know, affect my leg. And he said, oh, no, Roundup's perfectly safe. Or he said, you know, I have Guillain-Barré, and it happened 2 weeks after a flu shot. And I thought to myself, you know what? I think that flu shot caused my Guillain-Barré. So I went to my doctor, and then he sent me to a specialist, like you say. And I asked him, I said, is it possible the flu shot caused my Guillain-Barré? The neurologist said, no. And then he said, well, then I just dropped it because I thought, right, he must know. You know, it turns out it actually says that on the package insert, which means, you know, by law, they had to report that that happens. And then at some point, I will give them a mechanism. Here's the biology plausible explanation of how that happens. Very clear. If you inject somebody with an aluminum adjuvant and make them make antibodies, and one of the antibodies attacks your nerves, you'll get dysfunction of your nerves. There's no particular mystery about that. And the amazing thing about it is such a relief for them. You know, most people actually start crying because they've lived now for I don't know how many years thinking that that's what happened. Nobody believes them. They get worse and worse. Nobody can do anything about it. And what really bugs them is that nobody believes they know that's what happened.
Yeah, people know. They have that knowing. Yeah.
Yeah, they know, and they can't get it validated. And I tell you, one of the most important, I think, profound things that I do is I have them, you know, I've developed this very specific method of getting people to tell me their stories. I mean, it's even to the point where if you said, well, what's a human being? I would say it's basically we're a collection of stories, much more than we're physical substance. Like, I don't know how many atoms we have in us, but it's mostly space anyways. And I think the space is full of stories. And people know that, and they want their stories heard, and they want their experience of the world validated. I don't know why exactly, except seems like a primal human experience. You know, I want somebody to listen to me, and I know that's what happened, and it's such a relief, you know. And then I say, well, if that's what happened, you know, if it's glyphosate, then we have to get it out of your body. Or if it's whatever, we have to deal with that. So I let the experience tell me the unique experience of this particular patient, tell me what I need to do for them. And it's different with everybody. And so I have my bag of tricks, but I've learned to be as little prejudiced as possible. Because I don't know what happened to them, but they do. People know.
Oh, that's I have to agree 100%. I found that true too. If you just let people trust what they know, you know, encourage them to trust what they know and say it. So today we want to focus on anxiety and building resilience, with the understanding that no matter what problem a person is facing, that adequate, appropriate treatment entails engaging every aspect of their being, and anxiety being no exception. So I'm just curious, how do you define health and healing? And how can we apply those ideas to anxiety? How do you define health and healing?
I mean, it's sort of a good question, and I don't know. I mean, I don't really spend a lot of time thinking about that. All I can say is I have a person who obviously had some reason to come to me. I mean, because I can tell you if somebody comes to me sitting, you know, the first time, hi, how are you? I'm fine. What, why are you coming here? I have no reason. I feel perfectly well. At that point, we're done because I don't have anything to offer them. And that may sound funny because I studied 40 years nutrition and et cetera. But if that's their experience, then I don't think I have anything to offer them. So I've never had anybody like that. Everybody has something, you know, their teeth are rotten or they can't see or whatever it is. You know, most of them who come to me have serious illness or they wouldn't bother to come and spend all the money. So that never happens.
Seen all the specialists too, probably.
Yeah. So that never happens actually. But so I just start there. So, and sometimes it's with the question at the end of this, or in 2 months or in a week or whatever time frame makes sense, depending on what their problem is. Like could be an hour if they have meningitis and then I'd give them an antibiotic because they might die. But that's not usual either. So whatever time frame makes sense, I want their experience of life to be better. So that's what I think of healing. And partly the reason I say that is because I have so many experience with other, you know, so-called holistic doctors, and they're so abstract, you know, and they're going to fix your microbiome and they're going to do, you know, make you clean as a whistle. And that's all, as far as I can see, nonsense, because you're not going to fix anybody's microbiome and make it perfectly normal. First of all, we don't know what a normal one is. And second of all, you cannot live in the United States and have an ancestral microbiome. It's just impossible. So the thing for me is to start, you know, what's your trouble now? What's your experience of life that you want to see different? Because I also believe that experience is their body talking. And that's the only thing that you can change at this point. Now, that may not be the same thing in a year or in a month, but at this point, that's what their body is saying. This is what we need to focus on, because that's what it's focusing on. So then we try to deal with that. Then we go to the next thing.
So that's what the body's presenting right now. So that's what you focus on.
That's what I focus on. I am one of the least abstract, you know, it's a funny mix of, you know, all these sort of crazy so-called abstract ideas. But when I actually come down to it, you know, I'm like a gardener, like I got to get this broccoli to grow, period. And it's not. And so I have to change the soil or something. And so that's what I focus on. So I don't get into, you know, sort of definitions of health and healing. I want to help you have a better life. That's where I'm at. And then you said something else.
The person's the judge of what that better is then.
100%. I mean, why should I tell them? I mean, I might point out, you know, hey, Jack, your blood pressure's 250 over 130. But usually they tell me, you know, I don't feel very good. I have headaches and I'm dizzy and I can't exercise and, you know, I'm a mess here. And one of the things, now high blood pressure is not a disease either. It's a compensation response, but that may be go along with it. And that may even be the sort of linchpin. So that's something, if we deal with that and essentially lower the pressure, like literally they're under too much pressure. And I don't mean that like, you know, Steph Curry's under a lot of pressure to make a foul shot. That's a different kind of pressure. I mean, their body is under pressure. So we need to know why that is and then deal with it. And then hopefully a lot of their experience is better. That's the point.
Okay. So if their experience is anxiety, what do you often see as the, like at the root of that anxiety? What, in your experience, what do you often see?
So the first thing I would say, and I guess I didn't realize this was focused on anxiety, because I'm not sure this is exactly what you're looking for, but here we are, so I'll tell you what I think. Number one, I don't particularly go looking to treat what are called psychiatric disease. So that's not something that
I read your post this morning. Yeah. Your blog post.
Yeah. Right. So that's number one. Number two, I don't remember anybody, any patient in 30 years coming to me and saying, my problem is anxiety. I don't remember ever having that. I have a lot of people who feel anxious, but you know, when you try to get to the root of that, why would somebody feel anxious? Well, if there's a bear, you know, approaching your campsite, you would feel anxious. And that's a good thing, because then you might think harder about, you know, like what you need to do to protect your life. And I would further say that anybody in the United States in September 2019 who doesn't feel anxious is not paying attention. Like, they have something seriously wrong with them.
I would agree with that.
So I don't consider anxiety a disease. I don't mean that I want people to be debilitated because of being anxious, but, you know, I mean, our biological integrity is under an assault, the likes of which I don't think human beings have ever experienced, you know, with the basic, what I call the three horsemen of the apocalypse, which is basically 5G and non-native electromagnetic fields. That's one.
Right.
Vaccines and toxic medicine. That's two. And glyphosate and bad food. That's three. There's others. I would put number four as the corrosive effect of compulsory schooling. That probably takes some explanation, but that would be number four. And there's some other ones. But if we just stick with those first three that have mostly to do with medicine, I mean, that's like the way I would explain this and how off we are in medicine. It's like if you were a dolphin doctor and you had gotten a call that, you know, we're calling from the Arctic Circle. We've had these dolphins living here for 3,000 years and they're fine. And now we're suddenly seeing a bunch of dolphins who are dying and sick and they're losing weight. And we wonder if you could come up and take a look and see what you think is wrong. So fine, I'm a world famous dolphin doctor. I go take a look. And I sometimes ask my patients, what's the first thing you would ask if you came to that situation as a dolphin doctor?
Has anything changed in their environment?
Yeah, right. I would not ask, do these dolphins have a genetic disease? Right? That's right. Not what I would ask. That's what most doctors ask, but that's not what I would ask. I would not ask, Does this dolphin here, the one that's sick, does he have a personality disorder? I would not ask that. It's possible he does, but I don't think that'd be my first question. I wouldn't ask a whole lot of other questions like, did the dolphin get a virus? That's not my first question. My first question would be, hey, did somebody put some shit in the water? Excuse my French there,
yeah.
But because that's what happened. Somebody came and they spilled oil and spilled DDT or glyphosate or whatever in the water, and now all the dolphins are sick, or most of them.
Yeah.
Now it's complicated. Why did this dolphin get sicker than that? And I don't really know that. And that may be for complex answers, but I can tell you that most of the reason why the dolphins get sick is because somebody put some stuff in the water. And I remember this when I was growing up. You know, I lived in suburban Detroit, but suburban Detroit even then was pretty wild in some ways. Like right across from my house, there was a wetland with ponds and marshes in it. And there was all these frogs. And I didn't like the frogs because they croaked and made a racket at night, so I had to like put earplugs in. And then around 7 or 8, the frogs stopped croaking, which was easier to sleep, but I also loved the frogs, and so it was a very sad time. Again, you could go, and if you were a frog doctor, and say, what happened to the frogs? And this one doesn't look right, you know, its eyes are glassed over and all that, and you take it to the frog doctor at Mayo Clinic, and they start running genetic tests and got a viral infection, et cetera. Well, it turns out what happened was they put DDT in the water and they killed all the frogs. And that's not surprising. Like everybody knows that, except apparently doctors, because you bring a human being who's sick and they say, oh, you must have a genetic thing, or, you know, you must be a nutcase and stressed, and it's hereditary because your mother was like that. Well, no, she wasn't. She, you know, and all these things, or you have a virus, you know, and nobody says, hey, somebody put some stuff in your water or in your body or give you drugs that essentially paralyze your ability to feel, and that maybe you're overreacting to that or reacting to that, it's actually nuts. It's just nuts the way that we think about these things. And nobody asks, I mean, ask, you know, the people who are listening, when was the last time your doctor asked you, so what's the environment that you're living in? What kind of electromagnetic fields are you exposed to? What are you injecting into your body? What kind of pharmaceutical medicines are you taking? What are you eating? Do you ever move your body? You know, do you hate your wife or your husband and fight all the time? I mean, this is the water that we human beings live in, like the dolphins. Mm. And nobody cares. Well, not nobody, but general medicine couldn't care less. Don't know how to ask, not interested, has nothing to do with medicine. It's literally nuts. There's no other way to say it.
Well, certainly when you put it that way, I mean, there's reasons why doctors behave that way, I think, and that's because they're basically trained to be the sales reps for the drug companies. And if there's not a drug treatment for something, they're not interested in it, or they don't know anything about it because nobody's taught them about it.
Right. They have this interesting view, you know, and not that this should turn into a rag on doctors, but although maybe it should, but doctors are the people who think the only way a human being has healed ever is through the use of a patent pharmaceutical medicine or a surgical procedure. They flat out deny that any human being has ever healed from a significant medical problem through any other mechanism than that. That is an extremely radical viewpoint of the human being and the history of humanity, especially considering that almost none of the medicines we use now were even around 100 years ago. So how did we survive, you know, however many years it was before that? Nobody knows. Don't know how we survived. Nobody ever healed from anything before that. Just imagine that. Nobody ever healed from anything. Because if you ask your doctor, is it possible I healed from my lupus because of change in diet, prayer, homeopathy, herbs? Nope, it's not possible. That's never happens. It's simply not a possible experience that a living being has. I mean, and then they say, well, we only believe in double blind studies. I'd love to see a double blind study that proves that.
Oh, that's the only way to heal? Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Yeah. We did a double blind study. We found not one human being ever healed from a serious medical problem except with drugs or surgery.
Yeah, then they'd have to figure out what to do with the placebo effect, right?
Yeah, right.
So let's maybe the other emphasis of this summit is also on building resiliency, you know, being able to bounce back or being able to, like I said, stay healthy in the face of all these onslaughts. Do you have any suggestions about that from your perspective? I mean, obviously, get the stuff out of the water as best you can, which is not easy to do.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's you know, we're living through a radical experiment, which is if you expose biological systems, including human beings, to these kind of influence, can that being survive? That's what we're doing now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the answer is no. So that will be the answer to that question. So if you're a person and you're thinking, well, what should I do? The question you should the way you should answer that question is if whatever thing you're thinking of doing wasn't around 150 years ago, then you probably don't want to do it.
So can you say that again? If whatever you're thinking about doing.
Yeah, like if you're thinking, should I walk more? Then you ask, the next question you ask. So one person says, yes, you should walk more. The next person says, no, you shouldn't walk more because, you know, walking hurts your joints. And you could make a case for both of them, I suppose. So how are you going to figure out which one of those two is true? Number one, walking helps me be more mobile. Human beings are meant to walk. Number two, well, let's say you only get so many steps in your life. So if you take too many today, you're going to die sooner. Right?
Okay. No, I've heard people with those philosophies. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible. So how do you answer that question? Well, you say, well, 150 years ago, did people walk more or less than they do now? I think the answer clearly is they walked more. Therefore, I'm going to walk more. I think number one is right.
Okay.
Now, here's an interesting one, and it's a bit surprising because sometimes we believe, you know, things are more complicated than should I walk more. That's an easy one. How about this one? Should I eat a vegan diet? Right? A lot of people think that's a good thing. Plant-based vegan diet. Interestingly, I heard a debate on heart disease, vegan cardiologist versus a non-vegan cardiologist. The vegan cardiologist said, you know, we all have to realize there was no heart disease in the United States before 1940. He went on and on about that. He knew the literature extremely well about that subject. And then to my shock, nobody asked him, excuse me, Joel, how many vegans were there before in 1920 in the United States? I happen to know the exact number. You know what it is?
Probably zero.
Zero by choice. There may have been some who were so poor or debilitated that they only ate plants, but there was none. So if there was no, so we're saying, how do you treat heart disease? Well, some very important, prominent people will say you should be a vegan. 150 years ago, there was no heart disease in this country. How many vegans were there? None. So how is that possible that that's the correct answer?
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
I mean, it's very clear. So yeah. They walked more, they ate a bunch, they ate, you know, not, should you eat GMO food, right? Well, 150 years ago, there was no GMO food. There was no glyphosate. There was no vaccines. There was no statins.
On the there cows, was no... The cows were pretty much grass-fed and not grain-finished back then, too.
Right. Nobody was dumb enough to feed cows, you know, wheat because, A, it's too expensive, and, B, cows don't even like it. So why would you do that? So it becomes very easy. You just do those things. You know, how many of them were on their cell phone for 8 hours a day in 1850? I know the exact answer to that as well. It's zero.
Yep.
So okay. If you want to know what you can do to have a different outlook and health, now I'm not saying that it's not possible that we have some things that make our lives better, et cetera. That's, you know, but by and large, the big things, you can use that as your compass, and then you'll be able to figure it out.
Okay. Well, that brings up the other issue is, with the current state of soil in the United States, I think it's really difficult for people to meet their real nutritional needs. So what do you suggest about that?
Right. I mean, it's sort of a good question. I appreciate the question. But, you know, people say all kinds of things in response to that. And interestingly, I and my family, we have a business where we actually, it's called Dr. Cowan's Garden. And we get, you know, very well-grown vegetables and we turn them into powder so people can add extra nutrition and, you know, interesting varieties of vegetables to their diet. So I suppose I could say that answer.
Grown on really healthy soils, right? You make sure that
But yeah, the real answer, well, if the problem is we have crappy soil, which is poisoned, then the answer is, why don't we start making better soil? And let me just say one of the details of that, because, you know, one of the answers to that is, and one of the general cultural answers is, well, we should all be vegans because that'll help the soil, because the, you know, the cows and, you know, it helps global warming and all this stuff. So, but here's the facts. When the white people arrived on the Great Plains in the United States, that's the area between the Mississippi and the Rocky Mountains, they said uniformly, and you can read their writings, A, this was the most fertile soil that anybody had ever seen in their lives, right?
Right.
And it was, the topsoil was 12 feet deep,
yeah.
Right? That's what they said. So, okay, best soil ever. So what was growing on that soil? Well, prairie grass and buffalo and a few other things, but mostly that. So there was hundreds of millions of buffalo. And then over the next 50 to 100 years, the white people came in, killed all the buffalo and planted organically grown wheat and soybeans, mostly wheat in the beginning, right? Organically, because they didn't have anything else.
Right.
And then in 50 years or 100 years, it became a dust bowl. All the soil blew away to the Gulf of Mexico, and now it's a toxic wasteland. And so, in other words, converting from a bunch of herbivores, meaning buffalo, to organically grown annual plants, meaning wheat, that ruined the soil. So now what do people tell us is the solution to the problem of soils? Grow more annual.
Yeah. And fertilize.
I mean, right. That's the stupidest thing. How do you expect me to believe that? It's contradicted by everything you can possibly know about what actually happened. The only solution is bring back the buffalo or something like the buffalo and, you know, cut down all the fences, replant prairie grass if you have to, you know, or let it grow, and it will rejuvenate itself. But people don't want to hear that, so we're going to do just the opposite, and there you go.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that struck me is interesting about the young man you wrote about in your blog this morning, how he totally refused to listen to the facts about the treatment you're giving him. And
yeah,
that's, I'm sure, part of his psychosis. He was suffering from schizophrenia, but it sounds exactly like every climate denier alive today, or, you know, all these people that don't want to believe facts. They just want to stay with what they believe and not what the facts say. And most of those people probably wouldn't classically be diagnosed with psychosis, but it's just interesting how prevalent that problem is nowadays.
That, if you're American, you're psychotic.
Well, that's maybe a good way to answer that question.
you're anxious. And you have damn good reason to be anxious. And you believe in nonsense, which is, I guess, one of the definitions of psychosis. And no matter what evidence that anybody presents to you, you still believe in your nonsense because it's all in your head. That a lot of that happened through the influence of school, which is the indoctrination into nonsense program in this country. But right, it's a real problem because nothing, and of course it's difficult to get at real facts, you know.
Right.
That's a challenge we all face. But I mean, it's so out of control that it's kind of almost a joke, except it's not funny.
Right. No, there's a lot at stake. So Well, we're almost out of time. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I'm wondering if you're interested at all in talking about the Weston Price Foundation and how it might be a resource for our listeners or could help our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, the Weston Price Foundation is one is a voice of sanity in, you know, food and farming and medicine and vaccines and what you should and shouldn't put in your body and anything else. And, you know, founded by Sally, I've been helping her for 20 years. I'm still on the board. I'm the vice president because nobody else wanted to do it. And I said I would. And, you know, we try to help people figure out what's real. It's a good place to join.
I would encourage. A lot of patients get really beneficial information from there. So
we try to stick with what's real.
So are there any other resources you could refer our listeners to? If they wanted to really learn about, well, what should I be putting in my body and what shouldn't I be putting in my body?
I've written a few recent books and I have one coming out in about a week or so. They could check those out. One is called Human Heart, Cosmic Heart, and the other Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness. And then this one is called Cancer and the New Biology of Water. And all of those have, depending on what one's trouble is, they have a different perspective on how we got into those troubles or how you might have and what you can do about it.
So what were those books again?
The first one was Human Heart, Cosmic Heart.
Okay.
The second one was Vaccines, Autoimmunity, and the Changing Nature of Childhood Illness. Okay. And the one that's coming out, I think, September 24th, is Cancer and the New Biology of Water.
Oh, that sounds interesting. Wow. Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, definitely check those out. So if you could leave our listeners with three bits of advice about, like, how to become more resilient, more adaptable, what would you say?
Eat good food, don't use electronic devices, and avoid vaccines and other medical interventions as much as possible. And as much as you've done that, do it another 20%. And that's probably about how much you need to do it.
Okay. Well, the other thing I like about what you write too is you mentioned how we think about things is important.
Absolutely.
And conventional medicine, that's a whole nother realm that they pretty much ignore as well.
Right. And don't think nonsense. But you only gave me three, so.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's fair.
So avoid thinking nonsensical thoughts.
That's going to be
like
hard.
Glyphosate is good for you.
Yeah. Well, there's so much more I'd love to talk with you about, but I wanted to respect your time. So anything else you'd like to add before we sign off?
I think that's good. I appreciate you having me on your show here.
Thank you so much for all your time and insights. And it's really clear that you've studied a tremendous amount of information over your career and thought about things deeply. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you.